Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, where this week I am joined by Bob Millam of Allucent. Bob, I feel like I've been trying to pin you down forever on LinkedIn, with outreach, with messages, etc. So it's good to finally have you on. I know that your role has changed since I was bombarding you with pitches, etc. So look, in your own words, What is your role now at Allucent, just so that I'm clear on this?
Right. So it's kind of a mouthful. Global head of customer engagement. You know, when I tell people that that's my role, I get sort of a head tilt.
Yeah.
I think it's it is a unique role in the as far as I know in CROs. It is, I guess, another term to use might be ombudsman. So I am at Allucent. My function is to make sure that the experience that our clients see and are on the receiving end of it is consistent with our mission and values and what we purport to sell. So I'm a point of escalation. The idea is that I'm a senior executive conduit into Allucent.
Yeah.
For our clients to know that they can reach out to me at any time and say, listen, we're having a challenge here. I'm not really sure what's going on. And then I'll run back into our organization, try to establish what the situation is and work towards a resolution.
Awesome. I was going to say, it's very well put together, that response there, Bob, because I think you would have got a head tilt from me as to, so what is this then? So very much appreciated. And look, our audience is primarily those that are working in clinical research, clinical trials, etc. But for anyone that, I guess, hasn't come across Allucent, because I know that the brand is fairly new as far as I'm concerned, if you could give us an overview about the company, because I know it had a few different entities before and a few people have come together, sure, as is often the case in our world.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, what you'll see, you know, what you would see if you look at our website, we use the term purpose built.
Mm-hmm.
So as is, as you say, it's not uncommon in the industry. Allucent has been built by some independent investors, a couple of investment companies in particular, JLL Partners and Water Street. And their vision for what they were building was to create a CRO that is best situated, best designed to serve the needs of small to mid-sized biopharma companies.
Okay.
And the couple of things in order that we think, we believe are necessary in order to serve that client base adequately. One is that, you know, we have to be big enough to provide enough services so that we can support not just early phase, but phase two, phase three, and beyond studies. And that requires a global reach. And so we are present in 30 different countries. We operate in more than 60 countries. We are now at somewhere between 1,500 and 1,700 folks, split about evenly between the Americas and Europe.
Mm-hmm.
We have some folks in parts of the Middle East, in Tel Aviv and Turkey, and in South Africa. So the global reach is important. The other thing that was important for our founders and to us is that we are the size that we are. Right? Mm. There's not a vision in this company to become a large CRO like some of our former our fellow CROs in the industry, you know, with tens and 20,000s of people.
Yeah.
There's a lot of advantages in being that large, right? Obviously, you've got a lot of resources to draw on. There's a big well of experience to pull from. But organizations that are large, and I've been in large organizations, those by necessity have to build in structure and procedure and redundancy in the way things are done, so they can ensure that things are done consistently across those tens of thousands of people. We think that that's fine, and they provide a good service, but it is not best suited for smaller companies, smaller biotech and biopharma companies.
Sure.
Where, you know, a more flexible approach, you know, people use the word nimble, which I think that's overused, but if you want to use that word, that's fine. Where it's a flatter organization, so there's only five or six levels in our organization. So if you know, if our clients want to get access to senior executives, that's very easy to be to do, and that's, I think, represented in the fact that I have the position that I have currently. And lastly, I think the company has a breadth of service offerings through the companies that have come into or contributed to Allucent, so that we can help companies through all stages of that development process, as early as pre-IND packages, preclinical packages, with some of our consulting businesses, study design, including biostats design, and then executing clinical trials, helping with arranging meetings with regulatory authorities as the program develops, checking in with FDA, EMA, MHRA to say, you know, we've got this data. Is this design appropriate? You know, we have experience. We have folks who have been senior level folks in those regulatory bodies that bring a breadth of experience, but also a knowledge of how those organizations work. And then finally, you know, that when the data's coming in, we can put that data together and deliver that with our array of platforms, including our EDC platforms. We have a decentralized trial offering, and our I think our biostats and programming folks are as good as anything out there.
Yeah. So it's all, as you say, kind of like in the name, it's purpose built. It's all very much by design.
Right.
Is the sense that I'm getting there.
Yeah.
Now, I guess you've elevated yourself to this fairly lofty position, albeit you openly said that there's not too many layers. And again, right, that is by design. But look, talk to us about your background, Bob, because as you say, like, you've been in the game for a while. How did you get into clinical research, fall into research? If I was to, let's hear about your backstory. We've heard about the company. How did you get here?
Yeah, so I think fall into it is, you know, I'm not sure purpose-built could be applied to my own career. not that it hasn't been extraordinarily rewarding. So I'm a biochemist by training. I have an undergraduate degree in biology, and a graduate degree. It says microbiology, but really it was mostly protein biochemistry and immunology. But when I was, you know, at undergraduate and thinking about what, you know, what am I going to do? Who am I going to be when I grow up? My plan was to be a secondary school teacher. So I was actually a high school biology and chemistry teacher for a number of years. And I always tell people I'll never have a better job than that.
Really?
When that job is rewarding, there is nothing that can compare for me to, because I think science is, for me, I'm a scientist first and foremost, and
Hmm.
I think science is awe-inspiring. It's magical. It's exciting. It just blows me away. And I went to college with my number of my best friends from college never took a science course because they hated science in high school, and I couldn't understand that. So
Right.
I was a high school teacher for a number of years. I really enjoyed it, but it wasn't something that I could do for 30 years and continue to be the kind of teacher that I wanted to be. So
Right.
I left teaching a while ago, and was like, okay, so now what am I going to do? I worked for a state government agency for a while doing drinking water quality. I worked for a very, very small 16-person biotech company that dealt in blood coagulation enzymes. And then I ended up with a company that was a joint venture between Pfizer and a seed company working on genetically engineered crops, doing protein biochemistry, developing ELISAs and other assays to detect those transgenic proteins being expressed in this case, in corn. That joint venture was in the process of, I was there for a few years. It was in the process of being acquired by another large company that I didn't particularly want to work for. By that time, my wife, who's a molecular biologist, a very accomplished scientist, was working at Pfizer, and I knew some other people there, so I was able to get in there. But speaking of my wife, that transition from I'm going to be a teacher for the rest of my life, like I had no conception, like I couldn't conceive of doing anything else.
Right.
And when I was getting to the point where I was like, oh, this is really hard and it's really draining on me, and I'm not sure, that I can do this anymore, it was my wife who said, you can do something else. And it was one of those, because, you can tell I'm not 20 years old anymore, clearly. My dad worked for the same company his entire career. And so I just sort of thought, I'm going to be a teacher. I worked with all kinds of teachers that were in the business for 30 years. That was all they ever did. So it wasn't clear to me that I had that kind of opportunity. And Michelle said, you could do something else. You don't have to stay there.
Yeah,
Um,
wow.
so so that was a push I needed to get there. So I ended up at Pfizer. I worked in the lab for a little while. And then, it's been the case since then and throughout my career, I've been really fortunate that I've had mentors and line managers, and many of those mentors have been my line manager, who supported, if I expressed an interest for something that wasn't currently in my job description. And one of the advantages of being at a large company like Pfizer is there's a lot of things that you can do. My supervisor in the lab started bringing, putting me on a project that had, I was developing an assay for clinical trials. So she started bringing me to the clinical team meetings. I got to know some of the people there. And so after a few years of doing the assay development, I reached out to some people in the clinical and the oncology business unit at Pfizer, and said, so how can I help more with this clinical trial stuff? I'm really interested in this clinical trial stuff. And this was early 2000s, 2001, I think, 2002.
Do you remember
And
what brought on the interest in that particular line at the time? You know,
So, well, there were a couple things. One, I maybe it's an over developed ego, but if in the lab as a non-PhD scientist, at least at the time, it was not typical for somebody with my academic credentials to be in a leadership position in the lab. And so I would be given a task, I'd do the task, I'd send pull put the data, pass the data along, and that was it. I didn't have an opportunity to say, well, should we be doing this, or maybe we should do that. To get into a lab leadership position without a PhD is very challenging. Not that it's not been done. So I thought, maybe I could be more involved in the design of the experiment, if you will, if I was participating in it from the clinical side. And that's been my experience. I just wanted, when I approached the oncology clinical unit, I just wanted to learn more and find out some more, and maybe I could, play in the sandbox a bit. And this was when biomarkers were brand new, and they were very sexy, but nobody knew what they were supposed, how they were supposed to be used, and how to collect the samples and all that kind of stuff. But I was given an opportunity to move into the clinical business, the oncology business unit, as a translational medicine scientist. So I got to.
When you say given an opportunity, because a moment ago you said you kind of asked or you were approached them, how did was it literally like walking into their office and saying like expressing an interest? How did the ask go? Because I'm just thinking of
So,
other people that
yeah,
similar positions,
so
I guess.
it was, I'm providing these services, basically, like, I can, somebody has a need to find a biomarker vendor, and so I would go talk to biomarker vendors and say, can you do these cytokine assays? Can you do these kinds of ELISAs? And it was really just that. There wasn't any, and I felt like my role was pretty limited. I thought I had more that I could offer. I thought that I could say, hey, for this kind of an endpoint, you want to maybe look at this, or, have you thought about using this new technology that's come out? And so really what I did, I sent a note to the head of the early development line and said, Jeff, I'd be interested in trying to see if I could do more. Can we chat for like an hour? So I went in and we had like a half an hour chat, and he said, well, that's really interesting, let me give this some more thought. And 3 or 4 months later, he reached out and said, hey, I'm creating this position, it's called Global Oncology Biomarker Lead. I think I'd like you to interview for
Nice.
it. So it was just like, oof, oh my God. And so I did that for a while. I sat in on, I helped design the translational medicine end of protocols, and figured out how to incorporate those sample collections into clinical trials. And I spent a lot of time being frustrated with clinical operations because they take so long and it's so expensive, and why can't you get this done so faster? And then my boss was getting a new role as a development team leader. But he was leading this phase one oncology study, and he said, I'm getting this new job. Would you be interested in being the clinical scientist leading the phase one program? And I thought, yeah, but I'm not sure that I'm qualified. He's like, it's fine, you'll figure it out, you're really good. And so I literally got dropped into this as a clinical scientist. And I'm getting these lists of adverse events and protocol deviations and all this kind of stuff that, study managers sending me. And I
Did you
more or
know what you
less,
were doing No.
No. Honestly, I didn't. But I was surrounded by an organization that was full of supportive people. So, I would take these things that I'm reviewing out, and at the time this was in the before times, right? Everybody was in the office, and most people were co-located. So I'd walk down the hall, and I'd walk into Tony Olshansky's office. He's an oncologist that was at Pfizer. He's now at Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia. So I walk into Tony Olshansky's office and say, "Hey, Tony, what does it mean when a patient has these adverse events? Or are these lab values something that I need to be worried about?" Or, and they would talk to me for half an hour, 45 minutes, or an hour. And I more or less, like, so I picked it up, and I got more responsibility. And then I was interested in, okay, how do you, I wonder how
Do
this
you
people
think a
come
lot
up.
of that then? I'm getting to say that it came across, you got the support because you showed the interest. I mean, you've openly said that I didn't necessarily know exactly what I was doing, but because you were interested and happy to go away and work at it, the opportunities kind of just kept getting dropped on you to an extent.
Yeah, I mean, it really is just for me, I think, and there's a lot of good fortune involved in that. Right place, right time, all that kind of stuff. And I had people in my universe or solar system or whatever you want to call it, that would be supportive of those kinds of things. But I think people like to I certainly like talking about, as you can tell, I like talking about what I do. And I think people generally like to talk about what they know. And fortunately, the people that I talked with were patient with what I thought were dumb questions. And that led into discussions of, okay, now, are we measuring the right things here? And what does it mean to use RECIST criteria? And why is this imaging used for this indication and this imaging platform used for that indication? So we really just ended up just sucking in a lot of knowledge. It scientifically, it was fascinating for me. I was able to do more and more in support of these programs. And I spent, one thing that came up, Pfizer was interested in expanding. Pfizer always had a or for many, many years had a Japanese business unit. And they were interested in doing more work in Korea and possibly in China. And this was at the time when EGFR inhibitors were just becoming used. So Tarceva and Iressa had just been approved. And information about the fact that for some reason, people who were female by gender and Asian tended to respond better. More of those people responded to these EGFR inhibitors than did people without those characteristics. And it eventually we figured out, oh, it's EGFR activating mutations, and we know what those are, and we target those very specifically. We know that if you give somebody Tarceva for a year or 2 years, that eventually that tumor will develop resistance, and we know where those hotspots are. We didn't know any of that at that point. We just knew that Asia would be probably a good place for us to run those trials. And I was like, oh, I'm interested in that. Can I do that? And the lead for the program said, yeah, sure, fine. Put something together and see, if it makes sense, then yeah, sure, you can do that. So I got to participate in Pfizer's first phase one study in Korea. I helped to do the discussions with the regulatory agencies. I worked a lot in Japan. I did a lot of work in China. It was like, what am I doing there, right? That's what I kept thinking to myself. Like, how did I get in this place? And when is the guy going to walk in the door and say, who is this guy? And what is he doing here? Because he is not qualified. Hasn't happened yet.
Incredible. Well, I'm just as you're explaining this and thinking with your teaching roots or background, it's almost as if you've taken on the role of like the star pupil who's the
Yeah, I
just
don't know about star
that one
people.
individual who's like, you know what, I don't really know what we're doing here, but I'm interested in it. I'm gonna put some effort in, I'm gonna ask some questions, and I'm just gonna do it. And lo and behold, normally that individual ends up being top of the class by some miraculous miracle. And it seems like it's almost that's how it's gone for yourself. Because you've shown the interest, it's kind of ever elevated you, and all of a sudden you're looking around thinking, how did I get here?
And
Amazing.
that's what happened towards, the last few years I was at Pfizer. I was a development team leader. I thought, I'm a director. I think maybe I was a senior director. I don't know, I was a senior director. And I thought, this is it, baby. I have gotten as far as I'm going to be. And so, at most organizations, you have to do put together your goals, and then you have to put together your individual development plan. And I'd done that and submitted them. And I was talking to my boss, and I said, David, did you see my IDP? Can you review that and approve it? And he said, yeah, I guess so. And I was like, the heck, David? He's like, well, if that's all you want to do, because I'd put in things like attend scientific conferences, maybe present a poster, or just sort of stuff that I would do as a part of my regular job. And he's like, there's so much more you could do, Bob. I'm like, dude, are you talking to somebody who doesn't belong in the chair he's sitting in? And he said, well, come on, Pfizer's a big organization. There are lots of things going on here. You seem to have a really good relationship with some of the folks in the commercial side of the business. Maybe go talk to Jorge, and I can't remember Jorge's surname at the moment, but go talk to Jorge and see if you can get involved in some of the things that he's doing as head of the commercial business in Asia. And John Hubbard in development oper he heads up development operations. He really likes you. He's like the presentations that you've given when you're proposing studies. Go talk to Hubbard, see if you can learn something about development operations. And do like a job shadow or something like that. And I was like, well, hell. I thought this like I'm I thought I was, done growing. Maybe I've grown enough, and now I'm being asked to grow more. And so I did. I reached out to both of those folks. I did some really interesting work for in the commercial side, just sort of hanging around and watching things. But John Hubbard, when I called him, he said, well, hey, Bob, actually, we're hiring for a VP of clinical operations for oncology. Why don't you apply for that? And I said, well, John, the job description says MD and or PhD. I don't have either of those. He said, that's fine. Just put your application in and interview for it. What do you know? I got the job. Again, I think to myself, I am not qualified for this. I was a guy who spent all of his time complaining about development operations. Now I'm supposed to, run this and coordinate relationships with CROs.
Oh, how did that
And
go down with you, with you, Bob? But kind of after being the complainer, now it's kind of like, oh,
yeah. Well, it's
okay,
interesting the
so how's it
reception you get
gone
on both sides, right?
then?
Because they're, the people in DevOps are like, yeah, welcome to my life, buddy. But as I've gone through my career, when I went from the lab to clinical, all my folks in all my friends in the lab were like, oh, now you've gone to the dark side.
All right, yeah,
You're
you've
going to
changed.
join those people who wear ties and stuff. But then when I switched from the clinical science side to the clinical operations, all development operations, all the people in clinical, like, you have really gone to the dark side, pal. Are you kidding me? You're really going to work with those people? Two years along the line, Pfizer went through a reorganization, and I was like, okay, well, I had an opportunity, very lucky, very fortunate to get the opportunity to take a package after 17 years. And so I decided, I'll look for something else. I reached out to somebody who was the chief business officer at a CRO, Inventive Health, and I never worked for a CRO, but see what that does. And I reach out to him, and I end up as president of or general manager and head of the oncology business at Inventive Health.
Wow.
And it was another situation where I was literally, I was interviewing with the chief financial officer, Rick Shimoda, and he's like, well, do you have any, certainly you've got a lot of oncology experience and, da, 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 I think, all this stuff. And he said, do you have any concerns about being able to do the job? And I said, well, I don't really know anything about finances. I mean, I've never had to worry about it. I just asked my uncle Charlie Fizer, and he would either write a check or he wouldn't, and that was as much as I needed to know about the finances. And he said, that's okay. We can teach you that part. You bring something else to the table. And that was, I really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed it. And that company became Syneos. I was there for a while. And then what I found was I got a little frustrated with the size of the organization that I was with. I felt a little bit maybe there wasn't enough stretching room.
Right.
So I left. I
It's
went
having
to
grown as much as what you had to that point. If you then feel confined in any way, it's kind of like, well, hold on. I've managed to do this, this, and this, even though I wasn't necessarily technically qualified. But a lot of it sounds like a lot of internal networking that allowed you to make those jumps. And then if you're then kind of someone's putting handcuffs you in any way and keeping you in the lane, you probably. Would you say you just felt a little bit constrained? Is that
A
what
little bit,
you're
like, we know that you've done this and this and this. For now, we just need you to do this job. So please just do this job.
right.
Which, it's fine. I was well compensated, and but I just felt like there was more that I could do. And so I did some consulting for a little while, which was fine, but I like being part of a group. Like being part of a team, which is odd for me to say as an introvert, but I like that. And so I got a job working for a next generation's tumor sequencing provider. I was there for about a year, and the job again was fine. And I was thinking, maybe I'll retire. Maybe it's time for me to retire. I don't know. We'll see. And Rick Shimoda called me. And he was at Allucent. It was then called Cato SMS. And he said, are you looking? Would you be interested in looking? And there was an opportunity to interview for the head of the full service CRO business unit called
Is that
Control
Rick?
Operations.
The name is that the same guy from
The same
Inventive?
Rick. Yeah,
Right.
the same Rick.
I thought,
Yep.
yeah, I was like, hold on, I literally
Yep.
just heard that name. So, okay, so he had
Yeah.
moved and he gave you the call.
Right. And so I was like, okay. And my wife was like, are you sure this is really what you want to get into again?
You should have said, Bob, you should have said, Michelle, you were the one who got me into this.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, she he I spoke with Rick, and then I spoke with Mark Goldberg, who's our CEO. And the I tell people there were three or four things that he said that I that really resonated with me. One is that he brought the purpose-built thing up, and he said, Allucent, we intend to be a mid-sized CRO. We have no, there are plenty of large CROs. They are good at what they do, and they can continue to do what they do. Our ambitions are to be a top-tier mid-sized CRO. Secondly, he said, our client base, our target clients are the small to mid-size biotechs and biopharmas. And for the reasons I said a lot earlier, that we, the small companies are not always best served by larger CROs. And the reason is, at least in my experience, at those larger CROs, the driving business goal is to get an alliance partnership with a large pharma. So Pfizer, BMS, Novartis, GSK, those were the top targets. Mm. And so the business development teams were laser focused on those. And they had enough business that they could exert, I always say it's like a gravity well. And they tend to draw resources into there, and it's harder to serve smaller customers in that kind of an environment. And I think you can see, some companies have now set up biotech divisions so that they can put a firewall, I think, between those.
I had never actually paid too much attention to that. You know, I've seen like there's IQVIA, IQVIA Biotech, and that is, I'm assuming then, to focus on that particular audience or customer, as you're kind of highlighting.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, yeah, you can only really focus on one, achieving one goal. You can do anything you like, but you can't do everything you like, because it,
right.
You know, at some point there's going to be a clash.
Yeah. And I think, at a large pharma company, there's lots of infrastructure, there's systems, and things have been very well thought out. They have more people that they can assign to projects. With our the kind of clients that we work with, there may be 20 people in the company. I've got one client, there's maybe three or four people in the company, so they're entirely reliant on Allucent to deliver their program for them.
Mm.
And I think a mid-sized company has the kind of reach, right, that we have. We have folks in Eastern and Central Europe, as well as the EU5 and the UK, and we've got people in the US, but also in Canada and also in Central and South America. So, for a company, we punch above our weight, I guess is what I would say.
Yeah.
And so for me, that apply. And then the last that appealed to me, and the last thing that he said that really appealed to me was that we want Allucent to be a global company, not a U.S. company with a bunch of offices in different countries.
Mm.
And that really appealed to me, because as in the roles that I had previously, I worked with global teams, and I really feel like a corporate culture that believes in and promotes a global perspective on things is a more, maybe it's an overused term, a more vibrant place to work, a more adaptable place to work. And so, if you look at our website, at least half of our senior executive leadership team is based outside of the US. And that's, again, done purposely, because we think that that brings a different vibe to it. And one of the things Mark told me was, if you take this job, you're going to need to spend at least a quarter of your time out of the country, because we need to make sure that those ex-US parts of our business feel like they're part of the business and not just an office somewhere.
Mm. And how is that with the travel then? I'm assuming that you're used to the travel now.
Yeah. I mean,
is it a perk, like, or is it a pain?
For me, it's mostly a perk.
Yeah.
I like to travel. If I'm away for, sometimes I've been away for 2 weeks, and that's a little bit long. And there, sometimes the frequency of the trips gets a bit much. But for me, I like it. I like going and visiting people in their places. I like going to scientific conferences, because I can go out and get some science. And also, if I'm traveling, like, for example, I I went to the Czech Republic once. I was there for 4 or 5 days. My wife flew out and we spent a long weekend in Prague. So,
Nice.
you know, that's a perk for me, absolutely.
Definitely.
So, yeah.
Well, Bob, I mean, it's fascinating how, as you say, you've kind of, I don't know how you've done it. It sounds like you don't necessarily know how you've done it. You've winged it to the top
Pretty much.
somehow, right? But what of those jumps, I remember you saying that, when you're at Pfizer and you're kind of hitting that director VP level, you were like, hey, I've made it. I'm here, like, I don't know how, but I've done it. What do you think it is about you or your characteristics or habits or values that others have seen in you to get that, because I'm sure that there would be so many people, probably everyone, watching or listening to this, thinking, why isn't that happening for me? Why do you think it is that it has happened for you?
I can't pretend to know all of the answer for that. I do think that I've been fortunate to have managers who looked out for me, but I also cultivated that with the managers. Like I let them know, hey, I'm interested in this. Oh, wow, that's really cool. Can you show me how that works? I don't like to admit it, but I am ambitious. You know, I think I can do something more. And so I'm going to be asking, can I do something more? But if you don't ask, you don't get the opportunity.
I think that's the thing. I think as humans in general, we all want to grow. If you run, you want to run faster. If you jump, you want to jump higher. In business, you want to go further. And it's just, it seems that curiosity and willingness to put your hand up and say, hey, I'll do it, even if you
Yeah.
didn't know how to do it, has been the differentiator. Of the jumps or the successes that you've had, has there been anyone that's stood out perhaps the most, if you were to try and pinpoint, perhaps you may not have even thought about this before, but like looking back on it, having just sort of shared this for,
My career highlight kind of thing.
what would you say?
Well, I guess I'd say two. One was that move from the clinical side to the DevOps side, you know, when John Hubbard gave me the opportunity that he did. I went down to he I was always based at the Pfizer Groton location, and his office was down in the in Collegeville, in what used to be the Wyeth Labs location. So I went down to see him and to meet with some other people shortly after I was hired, and we're sitting in his nice office, and you know, he's a great guy, but I'm a little bit intimidated by this guy, and he says, so how's it going? You know, what do you think? And I said, well, John, honestly, I'm pretty sure I can do this job. I don't know. I'm not sure that I know how to do this job. And he said, that's fine. We can coach you through that. And one of the things he did in that respect was to arrange for me to have an executive coach. And that, I think that recognition, that for me, that was a turning point where it was like, maybe it's okay that I'm not exactly sure how to do this. And it made me feel like, oh, all right, you're going to make an investment in me. That's a really big thing. The other, I think, is coming to a Lucent. You know, because I had spent a couple of years after leaving the last CRO I was at, doing some different jobs and consulting and things like that. And you know, I had one job, and my wife would come home from work, and Michelle would come home and say, how was your day? And I would say it was fine. was always going to be fine. It was never going to be more than fine, which is why I was thinking maybe I should retire. You know, I got the opportunity to lead these teams at Allucent, at Cato, then a different name, but I was humbled by the responsibility, the scope of the responsibility, but it was also, you know, and I, this was towards the end of the first round of COVID shutdowns, and it was the summer of 2021, and I went over to Europe. I spent some time in the office in Amsterdam and one of the offices in Germany. And, you know, I went out and I sat and I talked to people, and I was like, so how is it? Is it going okay? What are your, what's your life like? And they really responded to that. And it made me feel really good that I was in the kind of company where that kind of behavior was encouraged. Like, that was what Mark wanted me to do. He wanted me to go out and make sure that people were, felt like they were contributing what they needed, what their frustrations are. Because if we don't do that, then we lose our people. And the people is, if we don't have them, then we don't have anything. And so for me to be part of that kind of a company was very, it was really refreshing.
Sounds it.
Yeah. And so I felt really empowered to try to make not just the business succeed, but succeed by making our employees feel like they're part of the solution and invested in the success of the company.
I mean, I like to hear that, because I think sometimes as organizations do get to a certain size and do get bigger, some of that just gets lost, in my opinion. And that's where it all falls down. And I've been at organizations where you can sometimes you start to see it happening. You just, like, for me, like, as soon as I've seen that in the past, I'm like, I'm out. I'm out.
And I do think, you know, it's not that I do think that Allucent is a different organization, fundamentally different organization than it was as any of its various previous entities or parts. And so there are going to be people, always people, who are going to say, it's just not the company I remember. It's not the company I used to be with. And that's, the answer to that is yes. I saw that happen at Pfizer. You know, when the company from the late 1990s, when I joined it, to 2015, when I left it, it was a very different company, because pharma itself, the whole industry changed drastically. And Pfizer, for one, got a whole lot bigger. At one point, we were 120,000 people. Wow. And so people are like, it's not the company we, it's not like the family we used to have. And I'm like,
of course not.
Nobody is.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, that's the way it is. I think at Allucent, you know, we have gotten larger. Yes. I don't think we've fundamentally changed our commitment to being people oriented. And I think that, you know, when we speak with clients, when we meet with customers and say, you know, we're here for you, we want to help you succeed in this, that customers understand whether or not you're just slinging a line or if you're really invested in it. And I think if you go to a meeting, you've got a data manager, a project manager, a CRA, and a statistician, and they're all saying, yeah, I really like it at Allucent, and I like the fact that we can talk to you and that, you know, we follow through on what we say, and those kinds of things.
Awesome stuff. Well, in terms of, I guess, plans for you, for the business moving forward, you've already said that, you know, Allucent is very much by design. There's no grand plans to expand and become huge or anything like that. Yeah. So is it more of the same on the business front? But, you know, also, what about for yourself, Bob? Is it
I'm an old
that
man,
someone else
man.
Is going to come and poach you, or what are your plans?
I hope not. I mean, I don't have any intentions of making myself available to be poached, or whatever. I like my current job, because I like the interactions with the customers, even the challenging ones. I like being able to say, look, I understand where you're coming from. Because I had the same kind of challenge, right? I always said, why are you charging so much for this? Why is it taking so long to do this? Because I wasn't sitting on that side where I, you know, where I knew how many pieces of paper it was necessary to file. And in order to get from this part of the trial to this part of the trial, all of these things have to fall in line. I would just think 6 months should be plenty of time to do that part of the trial with no real understanding of what was involved. I do remember the first time a project manager sat me down in my office and said, okay, Bob, I'm going to lay it out for you here. In order for you to get to this point, all these things have to happen. And she asked me, how much time does it take to do this? How much time take to do this? And we add it all up and you're at a year and a half. Do you see now, Bob? And then
you sit there and think, oh, well, she told me.
Yeah, I did. You know, I was like, well, thanks, Grace. I really appreciate it. Her name's Grace Vandal. And by the way, Grace, thank you very much for that lesson. I carry it with me always. And then the other thing that I learned in transitioning from pharma, from Pfizer to the CRO side, is an understanding for what it's like to have to run your business on billable personnel, right? So if I have a project manager in my organization, if that project manager isn't doing something that somebody else is going to pay us for, then we have to pay out of our overhead. And the more time they spend on something that nobody's agreed to pay for, the more that drains the business. And so as a client, when I said, why can't you work over the weekend? What's the problem? My people will work over the weekend. And, you know, the response is that I've had to give to a number of clients is, we'd be happy to work over the weekend, but it's out of scope and you will have to pay for that because the money to pay for them isn't going to come out of nothing.
Yeah.
And that's that was a challenging thing for us to for me to come to grasp with and to have to be able to understand that.
Amazing. Well, it sounds like you've had one hell of a journey, Bob. I'm still just fascinated how you've just elevated your career. But look, to wrap things up here, we always close the show with a bit of a quick fire questions. Looking back on your career, if you were to give yourself one piece of advice, Bob, one piece of advice to your younger self, what would that be?
You don't have to know what the end of your career looks like at the beginning or the middle of your career.
Like it. Okay. And then my next question is, I guess probably, you know, is there any one particular book or resource or podcast or anything like that you would recommend for our audience? Doesn't necessarily need to be work related, just anything that you enjoy yourself, I guess.
I think one of the books that got me really, you know, I always was fascinated by science and, you know, I was always pulling things apart. And but there was a book by Thomas Lewis, Lives of a Cell, that I found really fascinating. And then later on, the book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, was very impactful on me from the perspective of equity and patient-centered, recognizing that, you know, patients in clinical research are patients first, clinical trial subjects second, and you know, that things like consent and recognition are important. So I went to graduate school. That's where I learned how to do cell culture, and we talked about HeLa cells all the time. And you know, we always knew that it came from a cancer patient from Baltimore. And I think we thought at the time it was Helen Lake, not Henrietta Lacks. But you know, it didn't come out until later how that the process by which that woman provided samples that ended up fueling research for decades to come. That, you know, the way that those were obtained were not, it wasn't okay. You know, we
Right.
didn't have those policies in place. So that was a pretty moving one for me.
Okay. Awesome stuff. Have to check those out. I've made a quick note. And I get we've spoken so much about, I guess, your career, work, business, pharma. What do you do to relax when you're outside of work, when you actually get some downtime, Bob?
Yeah. So we have Labrador retrievers, which they've been mercifully quiet during the podcast, but I volunteer with my older dog as a therapy dog. So we go to we visit schools and hospitals and stuff. And I started doing that because back in the day when I was a lab guy, I would go to schools because I still wanted to be associated with the schools. And as a lab person, you can bring in fun stuff and, you know, dry ice and liquid nitrogen and all kinds of stuff. But if as a clinical scientist, I mean, I'll tell you, grade school kids don't want to know about informed consent and case report forms. It's just not that interesting to them. So I was like, okay, what am I going to do? Because I think volunteering is important. So what am I going to do as volunteering? And so pet therapy is what I came up with, and so I like to do that. I like to play golf. I haven't done it in years, but I'm hoping to get back to I like woodworking. And my wife and I like to garden and hike.
I like it. Second person this week, this actually, it's talked about woodworking. What a gets you thinking, but keeps you active at the same time. Yeah. Oh, second person this week. And look, to close this show, Bob, what do you say is your number one golden rule for both life and for business?
Not always successful at it, but be kind.
I like it. Short, sweet, to the point. Pretty much sums up kind of that you talked about being, vibrant earlier, but the vibe that I get from yourself, Bob. So I like that. And it's been, as I say, after a long time trying to pin you down, it's been a pleasure to finally get you on the show with me to share your story. So it's a good one. I can't wait to get this out. So yeah, thanks again for being part of the Huxley Morton podcast.
All right, thanks very much.